Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. I'm Amy Stitch, an associate professor at the McBee Institute of Higher Education at the University of Georgia, and affiliate faculty with the Qualitative Research Program here at UGA as well. I also currently serve as the co-editor of the SIGS newsletter with one of our students here at the Institute, Erin Leach. As a guest host today, I'll be interviewing Dr. Kathy Ralston on interviewing. Dr. Ralston is a professor in the Qualitative Research Program at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. Her research interests include qualitative research methods, specifically qualitative interviewing and analysis of talk and interaction. Her most recent books include Interviewing, A Guide to Theory and Practice, that's published with SAGE, coming out in 2022. And Exploring the Archives, A Beginner's Guide for Qualitative Researchers, co-authored with Kathleen Demaray and published by Myers Education Press. Outside work, Kathy enjoys working with fiber and textiles and exploring the creative pleasure of spinning, hand dyeing, and weaving. Dr. Ralston, thanks so much for joining us to discuss a topic that all of our qualitative listeners will very likely know at least a little something about. And interviewing may even be something that some of our more experienced listeners may at times take for granted as an all too familiar tool for data collection, rather than a method that provokes very meaningful, often critical methodological questions that I know you're going to talk about today. So why don't we just start by you telling us a little bit about your scholarly interests in interviewing and how you got started.
Thank you, Amy, for that lovely introduction. So I first became interested in the methodological aspects of interviewing when I was doing my doctoral studies at the University of Queensland in the 1990s. I had conducted quite a few qualitative interviews prior to that as part of my master's degree in the early 90s. But when I did those interviews, I really saw them as a transparent means for gaining information about the world. So when I was doing my doctoral studies, I was learning about ethno-methodological approaches to analysis from Dr. Carolyn Baker. And I took a very puzzling excerpt from an interview that I had conducted in my earlier study, and I reanalyzed it. And then this analysis helped me to get better understanding of the performative work that goes into the co-construction of interview data, in the ways that interviewers and interviewees produce interview data together. And then also how, as a researcher, it's possible to cut and categorize the interview transcripts in a way that can generate findings that can actually distort the ways in which the talk was produced. Mm-hmm. So I think there's quite a lot of writing about that now. But Dorothy Smith wrote an article back in the early 70s called Theorizing is Ideology. And I used that to think about how coding-based approaches to data analysis can hide how researchers contribute to the generation of interview accounts. And of course, I've done methodological work on research interviews since that time, and I still am very intrigued by how research interviews get done.
That's so interesting. And that's a really lovely transition into some of those deeper methodological or substantive questions surrounding interviewing. Can you talk to us about some of the recent developments in interviewing?
Yeah, thank you, Amy. So over the last couple of years, I've been trying to keep up with the new developments in interviewing. And I have to say there's an incredible range of innovations that qualitative researchers can use to inform their work. If you look at the methodological literature in interviewing historically, you'll find that some of the strategies that are now being frequently used by researchers are not actually new. Mm-hmm. But I think what really surprised me when I started to look at the methodological literature is that in the last 10 years, there's just been an enormous amount of publishing in this area. So I kind of think about this in several different ways. So there's methodological work that looks at particular approaches to conducting interviews. There's writing that talks about working with particular populations. Mm-hmm. And then there's work in which scholars are using new theories to re-theorize what it means to do an interview and what interview data are. And then researchers are also taking up all of the new modalities that we use in everyday life to conduct interviews that differ from, I guess, earlier ideas of a research interview as a formal, place-based and in-person interview. If you like, I could talk a little bit in more detail about those four different strands.
That would be great if you don't mind. Yes, please.
Sure. Well, in terms of how researchers approach interviewing, I think you'll see a lot more writing on how researchers who use interviews can account for sensory awareness. Now, the most familiar approach would be the use of visual methods, but people are also using sound, smell, taste, touch, and so forth. And then there's also a range of writing that examines materiality as it emerges in interviews. People bring objects to interviews that are used as prompts to talk about research topics. Sometimes the researchers bring those, sometimes the participants bring those. And then researchers have looked at how technologies such as recording devices show up within interview talk and how people orient to those and what that means in an interview. And then, of course, we're quite familiar, I think, now with the use of images in work, whether that's moving images, use of videos that people orient to, or still images. And then sometimes the researchers can bring those images to the interview, or they might engage participants in generating or bringing their own images. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also writing on various forms of graphic elicitation. Researchers can ask participants to draw diagrams or timelines, and then they talk about those within their interviews. Mm-hmm. And you'll see work where researchers are tending to place and space in interviews. And then they might do this through go-alongs, in which interviews go along with their participants in cars or public transport, and then, of course, in walking interviews. Now, as I mentioned earlier, ethnographers have used these kinds of interviews for a very long time, mm-hmm. things like walking interviews. But I think what is different now is researchers do not necessarily frame their work as ethnography. And then you'll see researchers using new technologies such as global positioning systems in conjunction with those mobile methods, and also creating maps in relation to walking interviews and mobile methods, and that you'll see these in articles now. As a second strand of writing, you'll see a lot more attention now to culturally relevant approaches to research, and obviously that's probably long overdue. Right. I will find lots of guidance about how to work with specific populations. And I'll just mention a couple here. So how to interview children around play-based approaches. So you can see work where researchers are using toys or puppets. You'll see research interviews used in inclusive ways with people with disabilities and the various elicitation devices people use. Mm-hmm. There's work on use of American Sign Language with the deaf community. And then, of course, there's much work on how to work with people from other cultures. And I think some of this work does use participatory approaches where the participants themselves are key stakeholders in the development of the research topics. They might serve as co-researchers or even peer interviewers. So the participants are co-participants with the researchers, and they might act as interviewers with other people. And then, of course, because researchers are increasingly conducting research in countries other than where they might present their work, you'll see a lot of research that's methodological to do with interviews on translation and interpretation, mm-hmm. and what that means for issues of data analysis, the ethics and representation. And then, of course, there's more writing on how to conduct interviews with elite populations or how to recruit those for interviews and so forth. But I think if you look at the methodological literature that's been published probably over the last 75 years, I think probably almost any population can emerge as special in some way. So if whatever group you are choosing to conduct interviews with, it's just well worth looking at what methodological literature you might locate that can support your work.
Sure.
And I encourage listeners to think about that.
Great point.
Now, moving on to theorizations of interviewing, there's a good deal of writing that draws on concepts from post-structural and new materialist writing, and it reconceptualizes what interviews are and how we might think about them. And some of this is very critical of interview research as well, although there's loads of critiques you could find that have gone on for decades about interviewing. Mm-hmm. Researchers have used concepts from Deleuze and Guattari's book 1000 Plateaus, such as the assemblage, the fold, the rhizome, to rethink interviews and interview data. And then you'll also see ideas such as diffraction and interaction from scholars such as Karen Barad, and cartographies from Rosie Brodotti applied to thinking about interviews. And then I guess just to finish off talking about some of the strands of literature on qualitative interviewing, there's a host of work which looks at the modalities in which interviews are conducted. And of course, because we've all been living through the COVID pandemic that started in 2020, I think probably all of us have turned to online interviews as a way to continue our research during the pandemic.
Right.
But I think we also need to recognize that researchers have always made use of new technologies to conduct interviews. So when recording devices first became popular in the 1930s, audio cassette recorders, for those of us who were interviewing a couple of decades ago, and then telephones and also mobile telephones. And then, of course, moving into the 2000s, we have digital recording devices. And then, of course, what we're doing right now, which is an audio recorded interview over the internet. And I've seen some researchers from folklore studies use podcasting software to record internet interviews. So if you've not looked at this, there's actually some pretty cool tools out there. But I think you'll see now use of synchronous online meeting rooms, such as Zoom, which we all know about, to interview people across physical distance. But you'll also see researchers making use of asynchronous tools. And of course, we've had email for a very long time, but these text-based tools such as WhatsApp, and used for both individual and group interviews. And then just to wrap up some of the methodological issues, I think what I've really noticed in the last year or two is the rapid replacement of manual transcription of interviews. So, for example, you might be familiar with Express Scribe or Inkscribe, which were tools to help us with manual transcription, but now these have really been taken over by voice-to-text software.
Right.
Now, voice-to-text software has also been around for a few decades, but it's never been entirely taken up because it wasn't that accurate. But now that artificial intelligence has been applied to the voice-to-text software, the accuracy is probably over 90%. Mm-hmm. And so I think you'll see people using tools such as Otter AI or Temi or Trint, that's just
sure.
a few. But I think it's always advisable to double check any kind of transcription. So that's whether you use a transcriber, whether you transcribe these manually, or you use a voice-to-text program. I think it's just good practice to listen to your audio recordings, check the transcriptions, and just ensure that what you've put in your transcript is accurate.
Absolutely, absolutely. Despite having a vast array of these technological advancements that assist us throughout the research process, I don't know that anything will ever really replace the need for us to deeply engage with our data in meaningful, sustained ways that, of course, result in more meaningful interpretation. In other words, I don't know that technology will ever necessarily replace the qualitative researcher, but that's probably a topic for another podcast.
But yeah,
so,
good point.
So now, despite having all sorts of advancements in the field, can you talk about some of the persistent challenges that qualitative researchers face in learning to interview?
Sure. So I've been teaching qualitative research interviewing for about 20 years now, and I've also done some research on that, and I've got a project going on right now to do with that. Mm-hmm. And I also recognize that some scholars argue that you don't need to teach interviewing. Mm-hmm. And that's because as interviewers and speakers, we use our ordinary language skills to conduct interviews. And I agree that that's what we do. We use our ordinary language skills when we ask questions of our participants. But I think one of the challenges for novice researchers is not that they don't know how to ask questions and conduct interviews. We are surrounded by interviews every day. We listen to them all the time. We see them on television and so forth. I think the challenge is learning to become a really good listener and thinking about what to say next. And so when I look at transcripts, I find that novice interviewers are challenged to listen well. And that's because sometimes they're thinking about the next question to ask. Sure. And I know this because I ask them to reflect. And that's what they say in reflections. It was really hard for me to listen because I didn't know what I was going to say next.
Right.
So what happens is a couple of different issues. Things can happen. So the interviewer can fail to unpack what an interviewee has said by not asking any follow-up questions. So rather than asking a follow-up question on what's just been said, they move directly to the next question without regard to whether an interviewee has fully explained the topic. Mm-hmm. And what happens then if you just move to the next question on the interview guide is your interview ends up being really short.
Right.
So we know from narrative inquiry and narrative research that people very frequently give the abstracts of the story first. So they tell you the short story, and then as an interviewer, it's up to you to ask thoughtful follow-up questions to get more detail about an interviewee's meaning-making. Now, a related problem for novice interviewers is when they do try to ask follow-up questions, they can come out as long, convoluted and multi-part questions. You know, they might ask 5 or 6 questions because they're thinking on the spot of what to say next. So what's interesting when I've looked at how people answer those kinds of questions is they do a pretty good job of handling these enormously complicated questions. So I think, though, that sometimes interviewers, they don't need to do that much work. There's ways to ask clear follow-up questions just one at a time. Mm-hmm. And then that actually, I think, might help when it comes to data analysis, because if an answer has been in response to a multi-part question, the analyst has to go through a good deal of analysis to think through in what ways their question has been answered.
Right.
So I think another issue, and I think this potentially is related to the fact that we all are very familiar with interviews as a genre, but sometimes I find that novice interviewees are really challenged to recognize the implications of their own actions as interviewers. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for every one of us, whether we've done a lot of interviews or a few interviews, we just need to be really aware of what we say and then what happens next as a result. So I think some new researchers come to qualitative research thinking that they can be neutral and not impact what gets said. But it's been well known for decades that it's not really possible to not impact what gets said. So even mm-hmm. researchers who use standardized survey interviews find it very difficult to avoid engaging with interviewees because interviewees ask questions of them as they go along. So I guess my point is, even if you are following a script, it's just very difficult to follow that when it comes to actual real life interaction. Right. So when qualitative researchers are asking questions in open-ended or semi-structured interviews, whatever they do is going to impact what gets said next. And that even includes whether you say nothing. So even if there's a silence. So for example, if you were to ask a question, you open a slot for the interviewee to say something. And if you pause long enough, the interviewee will do something. And the next turn actually might be asking a question as to what it is that you want to know. But so whatever interviewers do does impact what goes on. And I think each of us needs to recognize whatever it is that we do and how that impacts what gets done, and think about our own, I guess, natural language skills and how we speak to one another and listen to one another.
Right. Excellent points. And again, a really nice transition into my next question about the interviewer, the person, and some of the qualities that might make for a quote unquote good interviewer. So Dr. Ralston, can you talk about what constitutes a good interviewer?
Sure. Thanks for that question, Amy. So I have talked to other researchers about this, and that was one of the questions I asked them. And then I've also looked at accounts from professional interviewers who have talked about that topic. And I think there's a good deal of agreement on what a good interviewer does. So firstly, they prepare well for interviews. They're good listeners. They treat interviewees with respect. They understand that to conduct a good interview, you have to be flexible. Mm-hmm. So what works in one situation is not necessarily going to work in another. And I've seen several places good interviewing practices likened to the improvisatory qualities of jazz. So sometimes you just have to make stuff up.
And, right.
And then my good friend and colleague, Judith Priestley, she reminded me quite a few years ago now that you just need to be skeptical of advice and that including the advice I've just given. So sometimes I think advice is appropriate and sometimes it's not. And so I think perhaps interviewers just need to attune themselves to the specific context in which they're working and also the people they're talking to figure out what's going to be a good interview in this situation.
That's great. Oh, I love that advice and think it's appropriate in this context. So to be a good interviewer, really to be good at anything, it would also seem one would benefit from a great deal of experience and learning from what we might deem to be failures in the field or what we might at the time call, you know, a quote unquote failed interview. Can you tell us about any of your own experiences with, you know, quote unquote failed interviews or any interviewing disasters that you've had? We've all had them if you do it long enough.
I'm glad to hear that you have had some, Amy. We should chat about that sometime.
More than I can count.
So I think because I'm a methodologist, I tend not to write off interviews as failures because I think if something goes really terribly wrong in an interview, then that will give me something interesting to unpack. Now, unpacking that failure might actually be quite painful.
Sure.
But I'll share some of my disasters. And as I think about these, I think all of them were because of my own lack of preparation, which I guess is the first rule of good interviewing practice, be prepared.
Right.
So I have conducted a couple of interviews that were I think they were great interviews, but when I went to download them or transcribe them, I didn't have a recording. So that is every researcher's worst nightmare.
I've had that nightmare. I can relate to that. I've had that nightmare.
Yeah, this is a nightmare.
That's right.
So the first happened when I did my master's degree. So I was using one of those digital Walkmans, which are antiques now, but it failed to record. But in that case, I was able to reschedule the interview. I had a very kind participant who agreed to be interviewed for a second time. But I think what happened there was the spontaneity that occurred in the very first interview was lacking in the second. And of course, that's foreseeable.
Right.
But more recently, this is probably maybe a little over 10 years ago, I think, I failed to generate a complete recording on a digital recorder. And what had happened, I'd been conducting back-to-back interviews all day. Evaluation study. Mm-hmm. And the space on my digital recording device, it had a little disc in it, filled up.
Oh, no.
And so I missed half the interview and I couldn't reschedule this. There was no possibility. So what I did as soon as I could, I wrote down as much information as I could from memory. Mm-hmm. And since I've read more on the history of interviewing, I think what's interesting about that is this is how anthropologists used to record their interviews by hand during the interview or after. So there's one account by anthropologist Hortense Powdermaker. In 1966, she was looking back on her career and she wrote about going back to her car after her interviews and writing as many notes of what the interviewees had told her as she could. Mm-hmm. And it so happens, because I'm interested in archival work too, I've had a look at some of the handwritten notebooks from a field worker who lived in Athens, where I live. Mm-hmm. She conducted interviews as part of the Federal Writers Project, and her handwritten notebooks, it's all in pencil. They're just incredibly detailed notes of her interviews.
Wow.
And I have to think that before people had, ubiquitous access to audio recording devices, they probably had better strength of recall than perhaps we do, because we just typically rely on our audio recordings. But I guess back to your question around interview disasters, I think both of these disasters could have been avoided if I used a backup recording device.
Right.
And of course, that's what I do. So I take along an iPad or an iPhone or something and record it as well.
Right.
I don't know whether I have others to talk about. I don't know whether you want to know anymore.
I think we would all love to know more.
Okay, so this is one of my embarrassments. So in another case, the interviewee selected the place where we were going to conduct an interview, and I had not met her prior to the interview. So we met for the first time and we arranged to meet at a cafe in another county and that I was not familiar with. So I showed up early and I was just horrified to find that this cafe had closed,
no
longer existed. And so the person I was interviewing had obviously not been there for a while either. And so she was very surprised. So here we were in a strip mall in a county I wasn't familiar with, trying to locate another place to conduct an interview. And I ended up recording this conversation in an open area in a grocery store, which had like a little eating area with tables and chairs. So as you can imagine, this was not a great setting and it was not a great start to the interview.
That idea.
And that's what I recall. I don't remember much about the interview, but that's what I remember. I do have a worse one.
Oh, yes, please. And thank you for your honesty in all of them. I think it is really helpful.
So this one, I guess was at a very busy point in the semester, and I had arranged to interview someone. And when I went to conduct the interview, I went to their office, which was on my campus, and they came to my office. And our offices and two different buildings a couple of miles apart.
Oh, no.
So obviously that interview didn't get done.
Right.
And that was incredibly embarrassing because it was clear that I hadn't done enough preparation to double check the location, that we were both on the same page. And I think that just goes to show that no matter how busy you are, you just need to really be systematic about checking the equipment and then ensuring that both you and the interviewee know where you're going, that there is a place, a space to meet where you plan to meet, and just double check everything along the way. So I try to do that now, but I've made errors along the way, as you can see.
That's great. And as much as we may learn from our failures, it is, of course, wise to try to avoid them.
Yes.
So we do what we can. So Dr. Ralston, who were some of your favorite interviewers?
Sure. I would have to say that Terry Gross, who broadcast the program Fresh Air, which is on National Public Radio in the United States, she's one of my favorite interviewers.
Yeah.
If you listen to her, these interviews just seem to be so smooth. But I think she has published a couple of books on interviewing, and in her introduction to those books, you'll learn more about how she does those. And you just need to be aware that she has a team that produces those interviews, and they're also not aired live.
Right.
So the editorial team smooths out the talk. And they also might even resequence the questions and answers. And then just as another note, and I think this is encouraging to all of us, she also has had some pretty challenging interviews, and you can look around for those. So I guess as someone who has, she's literally conducted thousands of interviews, it's just useful to know that she runs into problem interviews as well. Mm-hmm. And then I think what we can all learn from this is that to do a good interview entails collaboration on the part of both interviewer and interviewee. So interviewees can be uncooperative for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes we might never really know what those reasons are.
Sure.
But I think in other cases, we might also consider why an interviewer might be reluctant to talk to us. And then as a good researcher, look into the reasons that might be occurring and why it is that people might not be answering our questions. So that's something to think about.
Right, right.
And then you asked me about favorite interviewers. I'm not sure he's one of my favorite interviewers, but I think I really like looking at his interviews to see what he does. So that's Sacha Baron Cohen. And of course, he's not a broadcast interviewer and he's not a research interviewer. And he's also not necessarily generating information as researchers do, because as a comedian and a satirist, he's doing something else altogether.
Right.
So you probably have seen him in his various television shows and films. So he disguises himself to interview both ordinary and very famous people. Mm-hmm. He's pranked quite a few very famous politicians that you don't have to look very far to see. I've seen Maureen Dowd of the New York Times has interviewed him and about his work and what he's trying to do there. And he describes his aim as to expose hatred, bigotry, and racism through those kinds of interviews. Mm-hmm. So I think what I enjoy about listening to comedians and satirists when they interview is how they upset our expectations of what an interview is, and also quite often what's appropriate to ask. And then, of course, interviewees are wide awake to what's going on quite often. And so sometimes they'll just walk out of the interview and just refuse to participate.
Right.
Rather than to avoid these embarrassing interactions, which some of these interviews are designed to elicit. And I'm not suggesting that researchers design interviews to do this kind of work. But I think what I find interesting about them is that how it really helps us to think about the purpose of asking questions of one another.
Absolutely. Yeah, those are such interesting choices. Have you heard Terry Gross interview Sacha Baron Cohen on Fresh Air?
You know, I haven't.
Now that's a 2-for-1 for you.
Have you heard him? Has she interviewed him?
Yes, she has. She has recently.
Yep. So there you go. I'm learning.
I believe just early this year. Yeah. So you might want to check that out.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. So before we end today, I think many of our listeners will also appreciate hearing some of your top tips for conducting interviews. So what advice would you give to those just starting out?
Well, I may repeat myself, so forgive me.
Sure, of course.
But I think first, I think it's really helpful to for every one of us as interviewers to recognize our natural language skills. So if any listeners are those people who like to sit and listen and who might be very introverted, it is actually going to be easier for you to listen to participants, and you are very unlikely to interrupt them because you'll be listening, because that's the natural way you engage in interaction. Now, if you like talking and you like telling stories, it might actually be very challenging for you not to contribute to the talk. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to be understood as saying that there's not a time and place for telling your own stories as part of an interview. Right. And if anyone wants to take conversational approach to interviewing, that's probably going to happen. But I think what I am trying to say here is that it's useful to recognize what your talk does for the generation of interview data. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, if you tell your stories in response to what your participant is saying, these are actually, there's a name for these kinds of stories. The sociologist Harvey Sachs called them second stories, which match a story that's just been told. Then when it comes to analyze your data, you as a researcher really have to be fair to your participant by accounting for your own talk in the analysis and interpretation, and thinking about what your part in the generation of that talk was. So that's one thing I think is helpful for all of us. And then, of course, this goes without saying, we just need to be listen to our participants respectfully. And I clearly, if we're using interviews, we're seeking to learn from others, and it's our responsibility to just really be respectful. Now, I think that doesn't necessarily mean we need to agree with them. So sometimes participants say very disagreeable things that we might really disagree with.
Sure.
But I think that in that case, then we need to think about how we can be fair in how we represent them when we write up our findings. And of course, representing our findings is probably a topic of another podcast too. But yes. there's actually methodological work out there now which really thinks about what happens when we interview people with whom we might disagree.
Right.
I guess the other thing to think about in interview is to really recognize that interviewing is performative. So people are going to represent themselves to one another in particular ways for specific purposes. So even though research interviews are about information generation, typically we are wanting information about some research topic, you can also ask what kinds of actions are being done in an interview. So, for example, your interviewee is justifying or excusing their actions, or they could be complaining about something or praising something or complimenting something. So that's just another order of data analysis which the sociologists Holstein and Goubrium have written about for quite some time, since the mid-1990s. They talk about analysing both how interviews get done in as well as what gets said in those interviews.
Right.
And then I think maybe just to finish up here, there's more methodological work which really calls on researchers to examine their research methods and how they might consider the participants' needs very deeply in how they examine their topics. I've got one good example here from Castro Dale. This is an article published in 2018 in Qualitative Inquiry. So he intended to use mobile methods in a study, but when he talked to his participants, they preferred formal sit-down interviews. So even though we might have preferences for how we're going to conduct interviews, I think more and more researchers are writing and talking about how they design their interview research with their participants' preferences in mind.
Right.
So I guess a good interview can look really easy, but we can't ever really predict what's going to happen past the second term. So I just advise all of us to be open, to be flexible, relax, and just enjoy yourself.
Well, again, that's wonderful advice. Thank you again for sharing your expertise with us today. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for this edition of Qualitative Conversations.
Thank you very much, Amy. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
As have I. Thanks so much, Kathy.